Welcome to Your Health. We've got a cool show planned for you on a hot day in Washington, D.C.
That's true. I'm April Fulton.
And I'm Rebecca Davis.
This week, we'll hear about the drinks that bring you up and the ones that take you down.
And the military sees a financial crisis brewing as healthcare costs for troops and veterans escalate.
Plus, FDA takes a closer look at one of the most popular cholesterol-lowering drugs.
But we're going to start today with food safety. We've all been riveted by that serious E. coli outbreak in Germany. And as investigators in Europe have struggled to figure out the source of the contamination, it reminds us just how vulnerable our own food supply can be.
That's right. This past week, Scott Hensley, our health blogger, and I posted an article on shots looking at the safety of food originating in China. Scott's going to tell us more about it. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Scott.
Hey there. When you go to the supermarket, do you take a look at where the food comes from?
Sometimes.
I actually do.
Yeah. I figured you. I thought maybe sometimes. I'm a sometimes also. Yeah. But this report made me want to look more carefully and also made me realize that there's a lot of food that it doesn't say where it comes from. Mm-hmm. But the report from a group called Food and Water Watch pulled together all kinds of information that was already out there to document what a big importer from China we are of food.
What are some of the biggest foods we're talking about?
I can tell you the top three.
Top three, okay. I'll take it.
By volume, apple juice, tilapia, and garlic.
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 Wow.
Yeah. The report explains why. There's some sort of business development reasons why, you know, China got into some production of some of these foods. But I would not have thought garlic.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't have crossed my mind.
Wouldn't have thought apple juice, really, either.
Yeah, apple juice is huge, actually. So what the group said is, look, it's hardly a day goes by that we don't hear about some sort of food safety problem in China. And the Chinese are grappling with it right now. The courts there recently said, hey, if somebody is found guilty of violating food safety laws that ended up leading to someone's death, then the death penalty is appropriate.
Yeah,
it's gotten
serious.
To that point.
Uh-huh.
So what this group is saying is, look, China needs to clean up its act, but also the U.S. should do a better job of making sure that the food we are getting from China and other places is properly inspected and qualified. There's some complicated ways you could do that. But
you know, I thought in April you reported on this earlier this year, but that there had been a change in the food safety law.
Well, they passed a new law, Rebecca, but that doesn't mean it's actually in effect yet. And it's not even funded, actually.
Oh,
so
okay.
We've got a little ways to go.
Right.
But the point of the new food safety law, one of the main tenets of it, is to strengthen the U.S.'s ability to manage and control imported foods. And one of the ways they would do that under the law, if it gets funded, big if, is to require foreign importers to certify that their food that they're bringing into the country meets U.S. domestic standards.
And I'm assuming there would be inspectors.
Oh, yes.
As
there's
well.
Inspectors
uh-huh.
now, but they inspect so little. It's the top food guy over there, Michael Taylor, I talked to him this week, and he said there's a thin line of inspectors at the port, so we can't really rely on them to check every possible thing coming in. So the new law would put the burden more on the importers and the manufacturers themselves.
We had another post not long ago about seafood, particularly, and the GAO took a look at seafood imports, and 3/4 of the seafood that we consume in the U.S. is imported. And what the GAO pointed out is that lots of the seafood is farmed, and the kinds of chemicals that are allowed some places overseas are not cool with government regulations here, mm-hmm. U.S. regulations,
mm-hmm.
but there's not very much testing done, according to the GAO, and there should be broader testing for more things. I mean, that was the thrust of the report,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of comes together with some of this. So there's a lot to be done, and I think people are now kind of corralling all the information and saying, here's the challenge. Now, what do you do about it?
Okay, well, we're going to come back to you a little later in the show, Scott.
I'll be here.
While we're talking about food, First Lady Michelle Obama has focused a lot on food and healthy food at that. In fact, her vegetable garden on the South Lawn is the perfect symbol of her desire to see Americans eat better. Well, it turns out that Michelle Obama is part of a long tradition going back about 200 years of Washington trying to guide the American diet.
Morning Edition host Renee Montaigne visited an exhibit here at the National Archives which depicts this history, including something every school child knows, the Department of Agriculture's formula for a healthy diet.
Meat group, fruit and vegetables group, bread and cereals group, that's a balanced diet.
This 1970s ditty from a children's show devoted to nutrition is among the many historical documents kept at the National Archives here in Washington, D.C.
You might not think that we have records about food here at the National Archives, but really anything that touches our lives is represented here. And food, of course, is a very basic, everyday kind of thing. And the government's been involved in it really since there's been a government.
That's Alice Camps. She's the head curator of a new exhibit at the National Archives called What's Cooking, Uncle Sam? What you'll learn there is that founding fathers Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin brought back from diplomatic missions abroad rice, olives, and other plants they hoped would help diversify the crops in their new nation. The first federal funds that went to agriculture went to the Patent Office in the 1830s to distribute foreign seeds to American farmers.
In the early 1900s, the Department of Agriculture sent explorers to remote parts of the world to gather plants. They had to deal with tigers, boars, bandits, people sworn to kill all foreigners, and we have wonderful documentation of those expeditions.
Camp says some of those exotic species they brought back are now everyday foods: apricots, persimmons, oranges, and the Meyer lemon, named after one of the most famous agricultural explorers, Frank Meyer. But not everything they brought back caught on with the American public.
We have some wonderful film footage, I think it's from the 1920s, of two women enjoying jujubes. And I think they thought there was going to be this great market for jujubes, but In fact, what are jujubes? You don't see those in grocery stores. Apparently they weren't very popular. I think they're sort of date-like.
The government did catch on to the potential of a new medium to spread the word on eating well. In fact, the Department of Agriculture produced one of the earliest shows on radio. One extremely popular show shared recipes and cooking tips and featured a woman named Aunt Sammy. Aunt Sammy, as in Mrs. Uncle Sam.
Get your pencils and paper ready. We're going to have some more recipes today. Now write this menu. Cold sliced tongue.
In the National Archives exhibit, along with a photo of a 1930s farm family gathered around a radio, there's a poster from the era illustrating 100-calorie portions of familiar foods. So,
to get your 100 calories, you could have a pound of tomatoes, three prunes.
That's amazing.
Okay, a bowl of cereal. Mm-hmm.
The focus, though, then was getting enough calories. This was during the Great Depression, and unlike now, where we're counting calories to keep them down, they were counting calories to try to get enough.
And as it still is today, the federal government back then was looking to protect Americans from food. Many food and drug laws came about in the early 20th century. Curator Alice Camps walked us over to a display devoted to a pioneer in food safety, a chemist with the Department of Agriculture named Harvey Wiley.
He was convinced that many of these substances that were added to foods as preservatives and dyes and so forth were dangerous.
And this is back in the late 1800s, early
1900s? Yes. So he wanted some proof of this. So he decided to test these substances on humans. In 1903, he started an experiment he called the hygienic table. He enlisted a number of young men, volunteers, to eat all their meals in the basement of the Department of Agriculture. And they outfitted this room with white tablecloths. They had waiters. They hired a chef. So the meals were very carefully prepared. But then these chemical substances were added to them, like formaldehyde and boric acid. So we have his notes where he recorded the effects of these chemicals on these young volunteers. And they often became violently ill.
Here I'm reading on one of these yellowed handwritten notes. Number 5 was nauseated and sick during the night of February 1st and vomited all of his dinner. He did not eat breakfast on February 2nd. Not surprised.
Harvey Wiley's experiment attracted a tremendous amount of attention from the press, which dubbed his team of young volunteers the Poison Squad. In those early days of the 20th century, there were even songs written about the Poison Squad. On display are the lyrics from one song used in a vaudeville act.
And it begins, "If ever you should visit the Smithsonian Institute, look out that Professor Wiley doesn't make you a recruit." He's got a lot of fellows there that tell him how they feel. They take a batch of poison every time they eat a meal.
The press had a field day with this, and it was the butt of many jokes, but the notoriety even helped his cause because people learned about it and became aware of the dangers of these substances, and that went a long way in helping pass in 1906 the Pure Food and Drug Law.
That law made it illegal to ship or receive any adulterated or misbranded foods like ketchup. On the wall at the National Archives is an illustration of a Victorian housewife leaping away as a bunch of ketchup bottles blow up behind her.
During the mid-1800s, it was sometimes prepared from the refuse of canneries, so tomato skins, cores, peels, sometimes rotten tomatoes went into this product, and it was then bottled, and the bacteria often caused the bottles to explode.
Many years later, the Agriculture Department almost classified ketchup as a vegetable in school lunches, which in a way gets us back to food groups. At one time, there were as many as 12. Ever since the first food guide was published in 1894, the government has drawn and redrawn the basic building blocks of nutritional health. Curator Alice Camps points to a pie chart from World War II.
And you can see there are 7 food groups here, and we really like this particular food guide because butter has its own food group.
If you looked at this, you'd eat as much butter as you eat green and yellow vegetables.
Yeah.
And the government added a helpful postscript. In addition to the basic 7, eat any other foods you want.
On the farm, we grow a food that's everything you need to eat. It's a fruit, a veg, a bread, a milk, a cheese, a bean, a meat. Hi, I'm Farmer Brown, singing about the food you need.
So today we see much less of Farmer Brown and much more, much, much more of caffeinated energy drinks, which seem to be everywhere. And while caffeine does have its benefits, the nation's pediatricians are raising the red flag when it comes to children and adolescents. They say young people should never drink energy drinks. So what if the energy drink is not a drink, but a stamp-sized sheet of gel, like one of those breath fresheners that dissolves in your mouth? Well, reporter Murray Carpenter has more.
The new product, called Sheets, is sort of like an energy drink without the water. This promotional video shows NBA star LeBron James in black and white placing a bright red gel strip on his tongue. James is not just endorsing the product, he's a co-founder of the company. Warren Struhl, another partner, says Sheets has some advantages.
You don't have calories, you don't have to make a pit stop, and it's great tasting. So we created a delivery system, as we say, a Listerine strip meets an energy product. Our product can be a replacement for an energy drink, an energy shot, or even a cup of coffee.
I find it very surprising to see how many different varieties of caffeine-containing products have been invented and marketed.
Harris Lieberman is a psychologist with the Army Research Institute of Environmental Medicine. He says the Army has developed its own energy product, caffeinated gum. It's now included in some rations because caffeine helps sleep-deprived soldiers maintain vigilance, and several energy drink bottlers are now marketing energy gum to the general public. Lieberman says caffeine's popularity reflects our modern lifestyle.
It's a combination of driving ourselves and having high expectations of ourselves, but also of society making a lot of demands on us, so they kind of add up to give us insufficient time to sleep.
We devalue sleep as a society. It's very clear, and that's been clear to sleep researchers for a long time.
Psychology professor Amy Wolfson of Holy Cross College says teens are often especially sleep-deprived. But instead of getting the sleep they need, she says many turn to caffeine.
And you wonder a little bit whether the marketers, whether purposely or not, realize that we know that we have a sleepy population of beginning really in seventh grade, if not possibly earlier, and that they're going to use these products in order to be more alert, be more attentive.
Scott Kilgore is a psychologist with McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. He says since we consume caffeine in foods all the time, we don't really take it seriously when it comes to our kids.
This is a real and powerful drug, so it can actually affect your sleep. It can affect your mood, a lot of other cognitive and psychological factors. So you need to be aware of what kinds of drugs that your kids are ingesting, and caffeine is one of them.
Kilgore says caffeine may affect young people differently than adults.
We really don't know the effects that caffeine has on the body and even psychologically for kids. You know, there's a lot of research in adults, but relatively speaking, it's fairly restricted with kids so far.
Just down the hill from Kilgore's office, David Beret is rollerblading with his friends in the park.
I drink a lot of Red Bulls and I drink a lot of Rockstars, but I see these new, they got Gumoat now, but I haven't tried the Gumoat yet.
Beret, who is 25, says he uses energy drinks to help him wake up and to get motivated for workouts. He also likes the flavor, but he says they aren't for everyone.
Sometimes I drink them and I'm all totally wired up. So I definitely think there should be an age limit, because if you drink too many of them, you're going to be off the wall.
In fact, on the Sheets package, it says children under 12 shouldn't use the gel strips. Beret says he hasn't heard of Sheets, but that's probably just a matter of time. The company just launched a $10 million promotional campaign with TV ads featuring star athletes and a billboard in Times Square. For NPR News, I'm Murray Carpenter.
Okay, if you're amped up on too much caffeine, awake after working the night shift, or just a little anxious, there's a whole slew of new products aimed at you. New foods and beverages that are claiming to help people relax. Reporter Gretchen Kuda-Crowan takes a look at what these foods are and what the experts think they do to us.
Caffeine-laden drinks and herbal pick-me-ups now keep many of us going throughout the day and well into the night. But what happens when it's time to relax, unwind, and even go to sleep? More mature insomniacs may reach for a glass of wine or some chamomile tea. But that's not the choice of the teen to 25 crowd. For them, the new rage is soft drinks.
Relaxation drinks are kind of the initial backlash to the energy drink craze. If I'm nervous or if I've been having a bad day, I can just crack open a Mary Jane's instead.
That's Eric Shogren. He's the man behind the California-based relaxing company, maker of Mary Jane's Relaxing Soda. The soda is one of a handful of new herbal products aimed at the stressed-out consumer. The name, he says, is a playful nod toward marijuana, but the soda actually contains passionflower extract and kava kava, two legal herbal products he says have been shown to relax people and reduce anxiety.
Our products aren't meant to make people tired or sleepy. It just kind of takes the edge off a little bit. If you're nervous or stressed out, you know, it'll just kind of take that edge off.
Soft drinks, waters, and even brownies containing herbal supplements like passionflower, kava, valerian root, rose hips, melatonin, and GABA are hitting shelves across the country. These food products claim to be the perfect antidote to a hectic lifestyle by causing relaxation or inducing sleep safely and naturally. And with cool names like iChill, Dreamwater, and Lazy Cakes, they're becoming increasingly popular. But the research on most of these herbal supplements is spotty, explains Brent Bauer of the Mayo Clinic's Complementary and Integrative Medicine Program. And even where there is good evidence that the herbs themselves do what the companies claim, once they've been baked or added to a soda, it's not clear what effect they have.
So there's no question kava as a drink by itself can work. The question is, can we take that information and then take a very small amount of that, put it in a drink, and see the same benefits? And I think this is where the science gets a little thin.
The FDA doesn't regulate supplements, so companies don't need to prove their claims with research or even standardize their products. So it's impossible to say with certainty whether or not they work. But Bauer says if there's an effect, then there's also a risk. And because they're packaged like food, consumers are likely to treat them like food, not medicine. Ziad Shaman of Metro Health Medical Center in Cleveland says that's certainly the case for melatonin.
It is a drug, and I'm repeating this, it is a drug. And just because it looks like a brownie doesn't mean it's just a brownie.
Shaman prescribes melatonin to patients in his sleep clinic and says it can be very effective. But he also cautions that it can have a host of side effects and shouldn't be used while driving. And most experts say not to use these products with children without a doctor's approval. But melatonin and other herbal supplements have been available in pill form for decades. So why is adding them to food and drinks suddenly all the rage? Dr. Shaman says putting the herbs in sodas and brownies automatically targets them at teens and young adults who are more likely to be up late and have poor sleeping habits. And Mayo's Brent Bauer says marketing them as natural alternatives to medicines adds to the appeal.
I think there's always this this societal interest in trying to find something where we can get it for free. You know, in other words, we want to find that nice herb that gives us an altered sense of reality but has no consequences. And so I think that's where some of this advertising is coming at.
Experts argue that although the drinks may be cool, when it comes to your health, good nutrition, exercise, proper sleep, and stress management techniques are going to be more effective at helping you relax and will have longer lasting results than herbal supplements in any form. And as for that cup of chamomile tea, feel free to indulge. It's perfectly safe, though there's no scientific evidence it will make you sleepy either. For NPR News, I'm Gretchen Kuda-Crowen in Cleveland.
And now a closer look at some spending that's driving up the deficit. The U.S. military is forecasting that the cost of taking care of its troops and retirees will keep growing. So much so that the Secretary of Defense says these costs are eating the military alive. Tamara Keith has more.
Retired Major General Arnold Pinaro gets a lot of hate mail because he's talking about something a whole lot of people don't want to hear, the rising cost of military health and pension benefits.
We in the Department of Defense are on the same path that General Motors found itself on.
Pinaro, a former Marine, is a member of the Defense Business Board, a group that advises the Pentagon on its financial operations.
General Motors did not start out to be a healthcare company that occasionally built an automobile. Today, we're on the path in the Department of Defense to turn it into a benefits company that may occasionally kill a terrorist.
And Pinaro's not the only one. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates sees the problem, too, and flagged it recently before Congress.
The Defense Department runs the risk of the fate of other corporate and government bureaucracies that were ultimately crippled by personnel costs, in particular, their retiree benefit packages.
Here's what he's talking about. In the past decade, military health care costs more than doubled, $52 billion in next year's budget. Retiree pay, another $50 billion or so a year. It used to be people worried about the cost of a fighter jet or bomber program would devour the military budget. Now it's health and pension costs, the same thing civilians are struggling with, says Pinaro.
Teachers are under fire. Government workers are under fire. Big corporations have walked away from these kind of pensions and deferred compensation benefits because they're unaffordable. And right now, the last bastion of this is in the Department of Defense.
Let's zoom in on health care. Secretary Gates says a federal worker not in the military pays about $4,000 a year for family coverage. The military has its version of health insurance. It's called TRICARE.
The cost of TRICARE for a family for a year is $460.
$460. That is the annual fee for working-age retirees. That's the group Secretary Gates has been trying to get to pay a little bit more. Not so easy. Just as GM had a union to contend with, Gates has his own challenge, Congress. Here he is last month at the American Enterprise Institute.
The first 2 years I was in this job, in the Bush administration, I went up to the Hill dutifully each year with a request for a tiny increase in the fee for TRICARE and got my head lopped off. And so the third year, I didn't try.
But he recently told NPR's All Things Considered, this year he's trying again.
We are asking for the radical change of moving it to 520, $2.50 a month.
Actually, it's $5 a month. Still, Gates is getting resistance from people like retired Air Force Major Joe Davis, spokesman for the Veterans of Foreign Wars.
When people talk about $5 a month being reasonable, yes, it's reasonable. It is reasonable. But the thing is, what comes next?
Davis argues you can't compare military benefits to benefits in the civilian world because the career of someone in the military is often so much harder.
In that 20 years, you have the possibility of picking up your entire family and moving about a dozen times. Oh, by the way, you're going to war. Your spouse will never be able to really have a career because you're relocating all the time.
That's a way steeper price than the $460 or $520 a year.
That's retired Air Force Colonel Steve Strobridge. He's director of government relations for the Military Officers Association of America.
DOD only looks at what the benefit to DOD is and how much military people are costing them in dollars. They forget and don't put any value on what it has cost the people to serve.
Veterans groups say if the Department of Defense wants to cut costs, there are many other ways to do it. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
That's an interesting story and reminds us that healthcare is just not getting any cheaper.
Didn't you have a post this week about cancer treatments that keep getting more expensive?
Right. There was a big cancer meeting, the biggest in Chicago, that was held last weekend and the beginning of this week. And while a lot of the talk was about the new breakthroughs for this cancer or combinations of drugs mm-hmm. that seem to work better, there were also some reports on the financial burden that these very expensive therapies are putting on patients.
Is that like a first that they've actually brought that up as a big issue?
I don't think it's the first time, but I think some of the things that they presented really hit home, at least with me. It helped me sort of grasp it a little bit better. So there was a presentation about some researchers in Washington linked two databases. One was cancer patients in Washington state, people who had been diagnosed with cancer, and then they looked at bankruptcy filings in the state of Washington and at it over years. Mm-hmm. And the researchers found that the bankruptcy rate for these cancer patients was 2.1%. And the risk of bankruptcy varied actually by the type of cancer that the people had, and malignancies of the lung, thyroid, and also leukemia and lymphoma mm-hmm. had the highest association with bankruptcies.
And Scott, as I read it, this isn't just a health insurance issue, because even people who had insurance had difficulty with the costs.
Right. There was another presentation there about people who did have good insurance coverage and all these sorts of ancillary costs, the mm-hmm. co-payments for the drugs, the sort of travel time, the lost work, all these things kind of added up. And they often had to scrimp to afford these extra expenses. So some researchers at Duke and Dana-Farber in Boston looked at quite a few patients and found out that almost half of the people said that they spent less on food and clothing as a result of some of these extra expenses. And they detailed some of the other sacrifices that the people made, but I think it just underscored that even if you've got coverage and pretty decent coverage for healthcare, there's a lot of stuff that insurance doesn't cover when you're really sick that could come back and cause you trouble.
Hmm. Well, the cost of treatments are definitely an issue for everyone, from cancer patients to your average middle-aged man on some popular cholesterol-lowering drugs, which you also wrote about this week. So FDA is concerned about the high dosage of a very popular drug, Zocor, right?
Yes. The second most prescribed drug in the United States is simvastatin, the generic version of Zocor, and that's the brand name for this cholesterol drug that was pioneered and sold by Merck. And what the FDA said is that the highest approved dose of this drug, which is 80 milligrams, has a significant risk of causing muscle damage, a kind of injury that can be painful, and in the worst case, can really cause you other health problems.
So it's muscle injury that they're concerned about?
Right.
Because often I've heard you can get, when you start taking a statin, you can get muscle soreness.
Right.
But this is actual injury.
It's damage. So there's a spectrum of effect here. So some people don't tolerate statins well because they get this muscle pain, and that is a red flag. That's something you would want to talk to your doctor about. Mm-hmm. But the kinds of things that the FDA was most concerned about was a little further down the spectrum, where you have real damage to the muscles and an injury to the muscle.
So the thing that we always end up with you is talk to your doctor.
To Scott.
Well, no.
Listen to Scott, listen then to talk me. To your doctor.
Listen to me, maybe, but talk to your doctor for sure. But I think that there are many drugs of this type, and so there are options, and the problems that the FDA pointed out here are specific to simvastatin. It's not for all the medicines called statins that could that can be used to reduce cholesterol. So it's a problem you can solve.
Okay.
Well, we're going to end our show today contemplating chicken liver pate.
And what with a dose of arsenic.
What might be lurking inside. Scott.
What am I, chopped liver?
What's wrong with my chicken livers?
This was another in our seeming series on food safety lately.
No kidding. Through line in this show. We are ending as we began.
Well, there have been a lot of food safety issues in the news, and we've tried to cover them. And one of the latest is a drug sold by Pfizer that's going to come off the market. This time, it's a drug for animals, and it's used by people raising poultry and pigs against guards against parasites. But the problem is, it's based on arsenic. The particular, what the FDA found when they went out and tested some chickens is that inorganic arsenic, a particular form of the element, which is carcinogenic, was found in the livers to be at a higher concentration in the livers of chickens who had been treated with this drug called 3-nitro.
And so is that generally the case that, I mean, when I go to the grocery store, am I going to buy a chicken that's been treated with 3-nitro?
You wouldn't
probably know.
Probably. Uh-huh. Yeah, you wouldn't know, but yeah. It's very common.
But the FDA is saying this isn't really a human safety problem at this point, right?
Because people don't eat chicken livers?
No, they did say that this is not an imminent safety hazard. Yet they were concerned enough about it that they worked with the manufacturer and Pfizer agreed not to sell the product anymore.
Voluntarily,
right. So the drug is still going to be sold through the beginning of July. But this is a medicine that had come under scrutiny before. It was approved in the 1940s, and there have been questions about it by various watchdog groups saying, hey, do we really need this out there?
Sounds like it's just adding to the debate that's ongoing about treating animals that we eat mm-hmm. With antibiotics, and that's been ongoing and will continue to go on.
That's right.
Well, thanks very much, Scott. This has been lively and informative.
As usual.
Watch what you eat.
Exactly. Watch what you put in your mouth.
And talk to your doctor.
And drink. Those are the take-home messages. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again. And we will be back again next week with more of Your Health. I'm Rebecca Davis.
And I'm April Fulton. Thanks for listening.